I guess it's just human nature, but oftentimes people who were born, raised, and grew up and grow old in a certain area don't really know some of the things about the area that they've always lived in that maybe outsiders know. You know, it's the proverbial person who's always lived in New York City but has never been to the Empire State Building or has never been to the Statue of Liberty, that kind of a thing. Well, a number of you know a certain amount about Birmingham, because many of you are natives of Birmingham. But I wonder if you know this. I didn't until I was doing a little bit of research. The U.S. Geological Survey from the Department of Interior of the federal government did a survey of the topography of Birmingham quite a number of years ago. This was actually dated 1910, but it's got some interesting things in it. Even if you've lived here all your life, if you were to describe the general Birmingham area in one or two or just a few words, how would you describe Birmingham, the topography? Well, according to this, the word that would be appropriate would be valley, Birmingham Valley. I mean, I see this every Sabbath when we get up and go up to Trenton. Much of the way, I see a mountain range on my left and a mountain range on my right. You're going not just straight north, you're kind of going northeast. Well, we're in a northeast to southwest valley. And as I said, the U.S. Geological Survey, this is something I bet Mr. Penny is familiar with. The reason for the survey was it dealt with ores, fuels, and fluxes around here. Well, there's a lot of iron ore. And so this survey was done. And fluxes, I wasn't quite sure about that when I looked it up. Again, I'm sure he would know what that means. Dolomite or limestone, those are purifying agents when you smelt metals and you want to get impurities out of them. You put another kind of rock or another kind of mineral in there to attach to the impurities. So they did a big survey, and they talked about the Birmingham Valley. And here's what they said. The city of Birmingham and its suburbs are built in the Valley region of Alabama. The Birmingham district is called the Birmingham Valley. This valley region lies between the east side of the Coosa coal field on the southeast and the Warrior coal field on the northwest. The major topographical features of the Birmingham Valley are Shades Mountain, which bounds the valley on the east. So I dutifully went to Google Maps and looked up Shades Mountain. And sure enough, there it is, Shades Mountain. Now, this was 1910. It may have other names around here, but that's what they called it then. But if you think of a valley with a mountain range over here and a mountain range over here and the valley in between, the Birmingham Valley, Shades Mountain on the east, and Sand Mountain. I know we still call it Sand Mountain. It goes all the way up to Trenton. You get up close to Trenton, Sand Mountain's on one side and Lookout Mountain's on the other. But again, the main features of the area of the Birmingham Valley, Shades Mountain, which bounds the valley on the east, Sand Mountain, which bounds it on the west. Birmingham Valley may be regarded as extending from Springville on the northeast to Big Sandy Creek on the southwest. So now you know, even if you've lived here all your life, that's at least what the Interior Department, that's the language the Interior Department would use, at least used to use, in describing where many of us live. Of course, many of us know Springville. We have members here that live in Springville. When I read that, I got off topic just a little bit in my own mind. I wonder how many people could make the claim that I can make. How many people have lived in Big Sandy, Texas, and in a region of a valley region with one of the borders being the Big Sandy Creek? Well, that would be me. It would be my wife. That would be my daughter. We're very special people, if you hadn't noticed already. Big Sandy, Texas, Big Sandy Creek. And unlike with the line of the sermon, I'm not going to tell you everything about why we're special, because some of it's not very good, but in any event. Now to the sermon. The sermon is about valleys. I wanted you to know you live in a valley region. Even if I hadn't told you all that I just told you the last few minutes, most of us, when we think of valleys, have a pretty good sense. It's a lowland surrounded on at least two sides by highlands, mountains. And if you study in the Bible about valleys, not only can you find some interesting things that tie in with real science, like topography and geography and geology, but some spiritual lessons, some typology that I hope you'll find interesting. A valley is a low area between hills. That's the Wikipedia encyclopedia definition of a valley. That makes sense. A valley is a low area between hills, often with a river running through it. In geology, a valley is a depression that is longer than it is wide. Otherwise, I think you call it, in this part of the world, a holler. If it's just a bowl-shaped area. But if it's longer than it is wide, if it runs like it does here from the Big Sandy Creek to the Coosa, if it's longer than it is wide, it's a valley. And that is a fairly scientific distinction. There's another distinction made by geologists between valleys and canyons. What would be your thought on the difference between a valley and a canyon? Basically, depth. Canyons tend to be deeper with steeper sides than valleys, according to geologists. So that would be the difference, scope of how deep it is and how steep it is. Now, valleys can be beautiful. I suppose some valleys are ugly, I don't know, but certainly some valleys are beautiful. They can be full of life and peace and beauty. And the Bible sometimes associates valleys with beauty and good things. So the first thing I want to see in the Bible with you is that valleys can be thought of as a positive thing, not a negative thing, but a positive thing, a beautiful thing. Sometimes valleys are associated with blessings in the Bible. As an example, God is going to bring the children of Israel into the Promised Land. And one of the ways that he describes the Promised Land is as follows, Deuteronomy chapter 8. He's describing the beauty and the blessings associated with Canaan or the Promised Land. It goes by different names, but let's look at this. In Deuteronomy 8 and verse 7, the Eternal your God is bringing into a good land. And then there follows descriptions of what makes it good, at least in God's description. This is Deuteronomy 8 and verse 7. The Eternal your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and springs that flow out of valleys and hills. Valleys between hills. Those are good features of the Promised Land, at least according to God's description. And then if we go over a few pages in our Bibles to chapter 11 of Deuteronomy, and verse 11. The land which you cross over to possess is a land of hills and valleys, which drinks water from the rain of heaven. So valleys, at least in these two instances, are associated in the Bible with God's blessings. And we think of meadows and valleys surrounded by mountain peaks and some of the nature photography we've seen. It can be very beautiful, very gorgeous, abounding in life. Here's another place in the Bible where valleys are associated with blessings. 2 Kings. This is just an aside in an historical account. We have a prophet of God who is dealing with both the king of Israel and the king of Judah in their contest with one of the surrounding pagan nations. It's a very messy situation. The relatively good king, that of Judah, probably should not even have gotten involved with the unrighteous king of Israel, but he did. And then there's a prophet of God, Elisha, in the middle of it. So you get right into the middle of the story. And this is 2 Kings chapter 3 and verse 16, and we see what happens here. God was going to basically bail out his people, Judah and Israel. Not because they deserved it, they didn't. Israel was very rebellious and following paganism, but God is extraordinarily merciful. Oftentimes, if there's even one righteous man associated with an enterprise, God will be merciful and he'll put some blessings on the enterprise that it does not deserve. Here's a classic example of that. A somewhat righteous king of Judah, but God's prophet Elisha. And they've gotten themselves in a mess. The army of Israel and the army of Judah, they're in a mess. They're on the other side of the Jordan Valley. They're on the east side. They're in hostile territory. They've run out of water. You've got an army that's about ready to perish from thirst. And so a great blessing would be water, and it's given in this valley. Let's read it. 2 Kings chapter 3 and verse 16. Elisha the prophet of God said, "Thus says the Eternal, make this valley full of ditches." This is a barren valley. Oftentimes valleys have streams with water in them, but this one doesn't. And the whole army is dying of thirst. And they're about ready to be either perish of thirst or be slaughtered by the army of Moab. But in this valley, the prophet of God makes a very strange order to the soldiers. Thus says the Eternal, "You shall not see wind, nor shall you see rain, yet that valley shall be filled with water." Miraculously, if they would just dig some ditches, they were all going to be filled with potable water, and it was going to save this army. And this was done in a valley. "That valley shall be filled with water, so that you and your cattle and your animals may drink." And this is but a trivial thing in the sight of the Eternal. It's not a big deal for God to just create water and put it in this valley in ditches they dug out so that it would hold the water for their animals and for them. So those are a couple of examples where valleys are associated with blessings. Now there's other symbolism in the Bible about valleys or associated with valleys. One thing that's obvious, as with any aspect of the creation of God, when we look at a beautiful valley, we ought to say, well, wow, what a God who makes something that beautiful. Any aspect of God's creation that man is not defiled is cause for us to say, wow, God made a beautiful thing there. What a wonderful creation. Who made the valleys? Obviously, God did. Now, there was a situation where, again, Israel is at war with pagan, superstitious enemies. And a lot of these nations that surrounded Israel had many gods and many idols. And sometimes they broke up nature. Instead of honoring the one God who made everything, which is the truth, they had different gods that they thought made different aspects of things. Like there was a god of the hills. There was a god of the trees. There was a god of the mountains, according to the pagans. And there was a god of the valleys. And this is almost comical. This is 1 Kings chapter 20. So here is a pagan nation that had gone into battle with Israel and had come out second best, the losers. So they huddle and they say, here's our problem. We had the wrong God with us. We didn't have the right God. Let's just read it. 1 Kings chapter 20. We need one of our other idols, one of our other gods to help us to fight against Israelites, because they have a God who's the God of the valleys. And we only had the God of the mountains on our side in that battle. That's why we lost. I mean, ridiculous. 1 Kings 20, verse 23. The servants of the king of Syria, this is the pagan nation, and their superstitious, multi-idol religion, their gods, that is, whose gods? The gods of the Israel. Their gods are the gods of the hills. Therefore, they were stronger than we. We fought in the hills. They have a god of the hills. If we can get them down into the valleys, they don't have a god of the valleys like we do. We'll beat them. That was the Syrian religion belief. Their gods, the Israelites' gods, were the god of the hills. Therefore, they were stronger than we were, because we fought them in the hills. But if we fight against them in the plain, down in the valley, then surely we will be stronger than they. I mean, it's just silly. Now we go to verse 28. Then a man of God came and spoke to the king of Israel and said, "Thus says the Eternal, because the Syrians have said," God is going to teach Syria a lesson. So he sends a man of God, a prophet. "Because the king of Syria has said," what we just read there, "because the king of Syria has said the Eternal," that is Yahweh, the God of Israel, "is God of the hills, but he's not God of the valleys. Therefore, I will deliver all this great multitude into your hand, and you shall know that I'm the Eternal." The true God can give victory to his people in mountains, in valleys, on plains, anywhere in between. He's not limited like these Syrian gods to just one fighting terrain that he's good at. That's the lesson he was going to show. So they encamped opposite each other for 7 days, and it was on the seventh day the battle was joined, and the children of Israel killed 100,000 foot soldiers of the Syrians in one day. I mean, that's almost indescribable, the carnage. This is a different era. So God is also the God of the valleys. He's not limited to helping his people up in the mountains. Valleys also in the Bible, since they are low spots, they're low spots. You've got mountains over here, mountains there, it's a low spot. Sometimes the symbolism changes. Sometimes valleys are symbolic of trials. Difficult, you know, the valley of the shadow of death. Sometimes we see that kind of language. Trials, tests, loneliness. Sometimes that's the way valleys are used in the Bible. Now, King David was betrayed by who he thought was his friend. It was a man named Ahithophel. Perhaps you remember the name. David was betrayed by who he thought was a friend and a colleague and a loyalist, this man named Ahithophel. And when did it happen? It happened when David was in a valley. It's called the Valley of Kidron, right on the outskirts of Jerusalem, going up to the Mount of Olives. He was betrayed by a friend. There's an interesting thing, as often is the case in the parts of the Bible that are history, when you dig down into it a little bit, you find some interesting relationships. We saw that in the previous series about keeping it in the family. David's family, Saul's family, a lot of his advisors were cousins or nephews on both sides of it. Ahithophel had been a trusted counselor to King David. And at a crucial time, he became a traitor. Well, it might help us with the backstory to realize Ahithophel had a son named Eliam. And Eliam had a daughter named, are you ready? Bathsheba. Ahithophel is the grandfather of Bathsheba. Blood is thicker than water. He is the grandfather of Bathsheba. Ahithophel, Eliam, Bathsheba. Maybe Grandpa never forgave David for what he did with Bathsheba. Now, God forgave David. Ahithophel maybe didn't. We see these things in the Bible. Maybe he kept his mouth shut for years, even decades. But when he thought the time was right, I am going to pay David back, even though God had long forgiven David. Here's another interesting aspect of that. I said Ahithophel, Eliam, Bathsheba. We'll get back to the valley here in a second, but just what happened in the valley? Ahithophel's son is Eliam. Eliam has a good friend, no doubt. A man named Uriah is a friend of Eliam. Uriah later married Bathsheba before David got to her. You can see all kinds of reasons that Ahithophel, his son's best friend, perhaps married Bathsheba, and then David ended up committing adultery with her, and then having Uriah killed. And Uriah was a good friend of Eliam. Now, you can put all that together if you want to do your own research, but why would I say Eliam is a good friend of Uriah the Hittite, who married Bathsheba? Well, there was an inner cadre of about 30-some soldiers. That's not a very big group. That's a smaller group than we have here. You all know each other in this room. No strangers in this room. There was an inner cadre in the palace guard that surrounded King David. They were called the great men of David. Two of those men, and they surely knew each other. They were in this exclusive club. Two of those men were Uriah the Hittite and Eliam, the father of Bathsheba. So Ahithophel has been a good counselor, been a confidant, been a wise counselor of David. But then we come to 2 Samuel chapter 15, and maybe years of secret resentment finally bubble to the surface. And it all happens in association with a valley. A valley of betrayal, a valley of a sore trial for David. Let's look at 2 Samuel chapter 15 and verse 23. This is the uprising, the attempted coup by David's son Absalom, the brother of the man we looked at the last two Sabbaths. But Absalom tried to overthrow his father before his brother did. And so Absalom has David on the run. Absalom's gotten most of David's army on his side. Verse 23 of 2 Samuel chapter 15. And all the country wept with a loud voice, and all the people crossed over. The king himself crossed over the brook Kidron, the valley of Kidron. David is one of his lowest moments. He's running for his life from his own son, and this is the very time when Ahithophel, his former counselor, betrays him. The brook of Kidron is in the valley of Kidron, and the people crossed over toward the way of the wilderness. Now we go forward to verse 30. So David went up by the ascent of the Mount of Olives. He's coming out of Jerusalem. He's gone down into the valley of Kidron, and now he's going back up toward the Mount of Olives on the east. So he's just coming out of this valley. David went up by the ascent of the Mount of Olives and wept as he went up. This is a time of great trial and sadness and betrayal. And the context is this valley. And he had his head covered and went barefoot, and all the people who were with him covered their heads and went up weeping as they went. The few that were following him, they realized what a terrible time this was. Then someone told David, saying, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. So David finds out he's betrayed by his former friend and counselor Ahithophel as he comes up out, or goes through the valley of Kidron. Now, as I emphasized a couple of things in that story, I saw a look of recognition, I think, in a few of your eyes. You know somebody else much later who was betrayed by an apparent friend, and it was an association with the same valley, the valley of Kidron? Jesus. Jesus was betrayed by somebody that appeared to be his friend, Judas. John chapter 18. Exactly the same geography. A similar type of trial. The greatest trial, leading to his death, having been betrayed by somebody that everybody thought was his friend, just like everybody thought Ahithophel was David's friend. This is John 18 and verse 1. We come to the end of the Passover service in this room that they had rented, and the foot washing, the teaching that Jesus had done with his disciples. We come to John 18 and verse 1. Jesus had spoken these words. He went out with his disciples over the brook Kidron, the valley of Kidron, exactly where David had been hundreds of years, 1,000 years before. He went out with his disciples over the brook Kidron, where there was a garden which he had and his disciples entered. And Judas betrayed him, just like Ahithophel had 1,000 years earlier, right at the same time as he's going through the valley of Kidron, a time of trial, betrayal. Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place. Jesus often met with his disciples. And Judas, having received a detachment of troops and officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, came there with lanterns and torches and weapons. Jesus, therefore, knowing all things that would come upon him, went forward and said to them, "Whom are you seeking?" Very similar. So we have the symbolism of valley as a trial, a time of betrayal, a low spot in people's mind. Probably one of the most quoted passages or chapters of the entire Bible is the 23rd Psalm. I alluded to this. There's the language, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death," at Psalm 23 and verse 4. So we've seen a number of different ways valleys are used and referred to and what they symbolize in the Bible. There's evidence in the Bible that the true story of geology, now you won't get much of the true story of Earth's geology in most universities, because most universities will completely poo-poo the idea that there was ever a universal flood. But had there been a flood that happened as it's described in the book of Genesis, it would have completely reworked the surface of the pre-flood world. In fact, in the New Testament, it says the old world having passed away, it wouldn't have been even recognizable after a flood. That much water covering the highest points on the earth, completely inundated with water, with vast probably tsunamis and volcanism. It says the fountains of the deep were broken up. There's language of maybe volcanoes on the floor of the ocean and just enormous reworking of the surface of the planet with all that water. Well, that's in the Bible. And I want to show you something in Psalm 104. I won't preach this dogmatically. It's somewhat open to question, but it certainly would fit in with common sense. If you believe the book of Genesis, that the highest point on the earth was underwater, you look around the earth today, is the highest point on earth underwater today? Of course not. There are places on the earth that are thousands of feet above the water. We're standing on ground. That's the other thing I read about the Birmingham Valley. On average, in this Birmingham Valley, we're between 500 and 600 feet above sea level. So we're 500 or 600 feet above the three-fourths of the earth's surface that's covered with water. How do you go from the whole earth being underwater to one-fourth of the earth not being underwater? Where'd all the water go? What happened? Well, the only thing that even makes sense on a basic level is that parts of the earth descended in depth and others rose up out of the water. And the parts that descended we would call the ocean floors, and the waters would flow from high points to low points, and they, after the flood, all this water had to go somewhere. Where's the water of Noah's flood? It's in our oceans. But the topography of the earth has been changed. Now, it doesn't have to be changed very much. Do you know that if the earth, and it actually looks this way from space, if the crust of the earth were perfectly smooth, perfectly round, in other words, no mountains, no valleys, it would be smoother than the smoothest billiard ball, and the earth would be under 2 miles of water. There's that much water in our oceans. That if the trenches and the floors of the ocean were somehow raised up, and if the tops of the mountains were somehow brought down, so it was perfectly round, there's enough water on the surface of the earth that we would be under 2 miles of water. So what happened at the end of the flood? Where all the water go? Something probably caused the ocean floors to go deeper, and something caused the land to be pushed up, the continents to be pushed up. True science tells us that the continental surfaces are basically made from granite-type rocks. And the surface or the floors of the ocean are basically made from basaltic-type of rocks. And one is heavier than the other. There's also a great deal of evidence in modern science that the surface of the earth, the crust of the earth, isn't all just one thing. It's plates, these tectonic plates. Now, you will read about that in geology courses in science. Just about everybody agrees now that there are 15 or 20, whatever the number is, plates. And they're kind of floating. We have a hard time envisioning that because it's rock, but they're floating on the underlying, below the crust levels of the earth. Well, basalt is 15% denser than granite. So granite will pop up. Just like if you have two fluids, the one that's the most dense will go to the bottom and the less dense will go to the top. If you put oil in water, the oil rises to the top. Granite rocks, the surface of the continents, is lighter. It's more buoyant by around 15% than basaltic rocks. So there's going to be a tendency for the ocean floors to sink down into the mantle and for the continental crust to kind of float to the top. Well, anyway, there's this verse in Psalm 104 that with that as backdrop may give us a clue, and it has to do with valleys. Valleys that were formed at the end of the flood, it was a year-long event. Big valleys called trenches, called deep trenches in the ocean floors into which all this water on the continents could drain off. Psalm 104, verses 6 through 9. You covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. This could very well be talking about the end of the flood, when it's time now to have dry land re-emerge above the floodwaters. You covered it with deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. At your rebuke they fled. At the voice of your thunder they hastened away. They went up over the mountains. They went down into the valleys to the place which you founded for them. As I say, this is somewhat controversial on the translation of verse 8. But some modern translations point out that what's being described, the them in verse 8, is not the waters, it's the mountains and the valleys. God prepared certain areas of the earth to be mountainous. So at the end of the flood event, there could have been volcanism that crunched together some of these floating plates, and they would have elevated and bunched together and become higher points, mountains. And he could have carved out some valleys into which the floodwaters went. The them in verse 8, so the Hebrew scholars tell us, is referring back to the mountains and the valleys, not the water. And some modern translations have that, like the English Standard Version specifically refers to the them being the mountains and the valleys. So God reorganized in some way, perhaps, again, I won't be dogmatic about it, but valleys. So yeah, we have valleys in the ocean floor. If you go to the ocean floor, it's not just flat. There are deep, deep trenches. Some of you have heard of the Mariana Trench in the Pacific Ocean. It's deeper. You could put Mount Everest at the bottom of the Mariana Trench. It wouldn't even come to the surface of the water. Deep, deep trenches where much of the water would have drained off to. Let me just read you a little bit here from a couple of science sources. It talks about the crust of the earth. It can be divided into two categories. The continental crust is made up primarily of granitic composition, granites, as I mentioned a minute ago, often covered by sedimentary rocks. And the oceanic crust, the floor of the ocean, is made up of basaltic rocks, which are heavier, as I mentioned. Basaltic rock is more dense than continental granite rocks. The continents rest at a higher level than the oceans. Again, think of the continents actually kind of floating to the top or being buoyant, and they are on the top, higher than the heavier basins of the ocean. The deep ocean basins thus contain a vast volume of water, allowing the land surface on which we live to be exposed. Well, that wasn't the case during the flood, but this certainly makes sense of how it could have happened after the flood, that the waters drained off into the deeper ocean trenches or valleys. Another source says the continents have a layer of continental crust about 20 miles in thickness that the oceans do not have. That's this granite on the surface of the land that you don't find in the bottom of the ocean. And granite is 15% less dense than the rocks on the surface of the ocean, the basalts. And that is why the continent surface stand approximately 4 kilometers, that's 2.5 miles, above the ocean's plane. Just interesting to think about. All right, let's move on. Something else about valleys in the Bible. We go to the book of Joel. God's final judgment of the whole world, right at the time of Jesus Christ's return, will be in a what? A valley. That will be a time of judgment. Let's look at the book of Joel, chapter 3. So, yes, valleys can be beautiful. They can be a blessing. God can save his people in a valley. Valleys can be typical of trials, but also they can be typical of judgment. Joel chapter 3. Find it here. Begin in verse 2. I will gather all nations, Joel 3 and verse 2, and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat. And I will enter into judgment with them there on account of my people, my heritage Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations. So we have a picture of the end of Jacob's trouble. Jacob having been scattered and persecuted, and now Christ is returning, and he's going to even some scores in the vernacular, and he's going to judge people. And we go down to verse 11, all peoples, all nations. Go down to verse 11. Assemble and come, all you nations, and gather together all around. Cause your mighty ones to go down there, O eternal. Let the nations be wakened and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat, this time of great judgment. There I will sit to judge all the surrounding nations. Put in the sickle. The harvest is ripe. Come, go down, for the winepress is full. The vats overflow, for their wickedness is great. Multitudes, yeah, the whole world. In the valley of decision, at least representatives of all the nations, You know, we read about a 200 million man army. So we read about conglomerations of people, perhaps that will have representatives from all the nations coming together to fight against, imagine that, fight against the returning Christ. They will have been so deceived. So that probably is what's being described here. That's why it could be said all nations. I mean, does it mean everybody alive on the earth will be in this one valley? Probably not, but at least representatives, more than likely is what it means, will be there. And I will sit to judge the surrounding nations. So again, we go to verse 14. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision. For the day of the eternal is near in the valley of decision. The sun and the moon will grow dark, and the stars will diminish their brightness. The eternal will roar from Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem. The heavens and earth will shake, but the eternal will be a shelter for his people and the strength of his children of Israel. Well, that's at the beginning of the millennium. Probably most of you are thinking, yeah, there's another one. There's another big valley event. The Valley of Dry Bones. At the end of the millennium, all the dead who have never known or had an opportunity may not be the best word, but have never knowingly rejected the knowledge of God with full knowledge, they're going to be resurrected and given, and it's going to happen in a valley. They're going to be given a chance to know and obey God. Ezekiel 37, the Valley of Dry Bones. Again, if you just look into real science, not polluted by evolutionary theorizing, you can see that there are some amazing things that are in valleys of the earth, either above the water level or below the water level in the oceans. There are valleys, trenches there. God has put life in unexpected places, just like that valley over there in Moab where God said, just I'll save you. You don't deserve it, but Elisha's here, and so I'll bless you. He said, just get out your shovels and dig out some holes in this dry valley, and I'll fill them with water for you and your animals. That looked like a pretty barren valley before that miracle happened. Well, there are other pretty barren valleys on the earth. And if you just heard a description of how hot it is and how little moisture there is, you'd say, well, nothing could live in these valleys. And yet God has made things that can live in the most unlikely places. And some of them are valleys. As I said, you wouldn't even think there'd be anything alive there. Have we ever heard of a Death Valley? There's a place called Death Valley in the United States. It's called Death Valley because just to look at it or hear it described, you'd say, well, nothing could be alive there. That's a place of death. There's some amazing things that are alive in Death Valley. It's 282 feet below sea level. Here's a little bit about Death Valley. At 282 feet below sea level, Bad Water Basin. Now they know how to name things out in the West. Bad Water Basin. Who would want to be there? There's not much water, and even the water they do have is bad, apparently. It's Bad Water Basin, Death Valley. Well, that's not only the lowest place in Death Valley National Park, it's also the lowest place in North America. Once part of a lake that dried up at the end of the Ice Age. I mean, do we know that for certain? I don't know that for certain, but that's what this one source says. It was once part of a lake that dried up at the end of the Ice Age. This basin was left with a high concentration of salt in a shallow pool of water. Well, what do we know about salt water? Most things can't live in salt water. Now, some fish can, but most things can't. Most things also cannot live in extreme heat. This hot, salty basin is home to the Death Valley pupfish. Now, maybe you've heard of Death Valley pupfish. I hadn't until I saw this. It's a little fish that can live in this salty water in Bad Water Basin in Death Valley, 282 feet below sea level. This hot, salty basin, excuse me, is home to the Death Valley pupfish that can survive in 112 degree Fahrenheit water. That's pretty hot water. They don't survive in it, they thrive in it. It's three times as salty as ocean water. Well, that's in Death Valley, but it turns out not to be dead at all. There's pupfish and there's other things. And on those rare occasions when a cloud with water in it drops rain on these places, they bloom like the rose. There are seeds. I didn't write all this part of it down, but there are seeds in some of the soil, the sand of the deserts and the valleys of the earth, that they can go dormant for years. Put a little water on them and they bloom almost overnight. So there really isn't a death valley where nothing can live. God put some creatures that can thrive in the most extreme valleys. One of my favorites already mentioned is the Mariana Trench. The deepest of the underwater valleys or trenches is the Mariana Trench at the floor of the Pacific Ocean near Guam. I wrote down a few things about this. The depth of the Mariana Trench is 35,810 feet. Now, that's taller than Mount Everest. In other words, if you went to the base of Mount Everest and then went up to the top, it wouldn't be as far as the lid of this trench down to the bottom of it. That's under the water. There's plenty of valleys for floodwaters to drain into at the end of the flood. Here's the most famous one, the Mariana Trench. In an article about the Mariana Trench, it says this, I think I summarized it a minute ago, were the crust of the earth to be leveled with great mountain ranges like the Himalayas and ocean abysses like the Mariana Trench evened out, no land at all would show above the surface of the earth. We'd be under 10,000 feet of water. So in one sense, to have a flood would be easy for God. Anything God does is easy. He's the master of creation. He spoke things into existence. It didn't take that much for God to flood an earth so that there was no land above the water surface. And it didn't take much for him. You know, when you're little kids, you go out and you play in the sand, maybe in the mud. And maybe you had a sand pile and it rained overnight. Any little kid knows what to do to get rid of the water. You just take your hand and you scoop out a big trench and all the water goes right in there. And now you got the rest of the sand doesn't have water standing in it. We already know that the basins of the ocean are 15% denser. With or without a flood, there's going to be lower spots with water on top of them. If some combination of things God did just to maybe even go lower, you've got plenty of room for the floodwaters to drain into. But there's life down there. 38,000 feet? Think of the pressure of 38,000. Water is heavy. Carry around a container with 1 foot of water in it. I mean, that's heavy. Water is heavy. How about 38,000 feet of it? Think of the pressure. Another surprise, when we've sent these exploratory manned and unmanned vessels down there, another surprise came from the Mariana Trench, the deepest part of the ocean. National Geographic showed pictures of crabs, shrimp, and other types of life, some new to science. We sent cameras down there. We saw things that had never been seen anywhere else on the earth or under the water. They're thriving down there under that kind of pressure. If you caught one of those things and just pulled it up, it would explode, wouldn't it? Because there are forces that are pushing out against all that pressure. Well, if that pressure was taken away and you brought it up to sea level, those same forces inside the bodies of these creatures would cause them to explode. So National Geographic showed pictures of crabs, shrimp, and other types of life, some new to science. Unfortunately, the robotic subcontrollers also photographed a spam can at the bottom of the Mariana Trench. The team led by James Cameron was dismayed to find extraordinary pollution levels. Things people have thrown off of boats or off of piers and they've washed out into the ocean. Somehow they've fallen. There's all kinds of human garbage at the bottom of the Mariana Trench. The trench and nearby areas are home to a variety of creatures. The point I'm trying to make, these are the deepest valleys you can imagine, with incredible water pressure on them that would make it seem that nothing could live without steel plate. You got jellyfish down there. How does God make a jellyfish that won't be crushed by 38,000 feet of water? Well, for God, it's easy. The trench and nearby areas are home to a variety of creatures, including deep-sea snailfish, glowing jellyfish, giant amoebas, that could have been exposed to these chemicals despite the trench's remote location. Well, that's, again, bemoaning the fact there's human pollution down there. Things get weird for fish that live in these kind of conditions, in these deep trenches of the ocean. A potentially new species of deep-sea snailfish with a bulbous head and partly transparent body. A body you can see through. And a big bulbous head lives down there. Has smashed the record for deepest fish in the world by over 1,600 feet. They go down there and they find something that's 1,600 feet lower. What's that, a third of a mile lower than anything else ever found to be alive? 5 miles deep in the Pacific's Mariana Trench, which extends nearly 7 miles, the video shows a fish at the deepest point any living fish has ever been found. Here's a quote from one of the scientists. It's unlike any other snailfish ever seen. Its head looks like a cartoon version of a dog's head. The body is incredibly delicate. You can see through it. You can see its liver through the sides of the fish. It's like tissue paper being dragged through the water. Now, just a minute ago, I said, imagine with me what it would take to have a living creature down there. Wouldn't it take a steel case? No, it's something so delicate you can see through it. How does God do these things? Well, again, God can do anything he wants. The more we look at places on the earth, including deep valleys, the more we should glorify God at what a brilliant creator he is. One of the people that saw this says, the way it moves is strange. It's like there's no structure to it. It just glides. One last thing about these snailfish they found way down there. Snailfish are no strangers to the crushing depths of the world's trenches or valleys, underwater valleys. Their Komodic Trench near New Zealand, this is not the Mariana Trench, it's another one. Their Komodic Trench near New Zealand and the Japan Trench further north each have their own species of snailfish. The deep sea fish can usually be found between 21 and 24,000 feet below the surface of the ocean. The deeper you go, the higher the concentration of this substance. Well, I guess I left out what the substance is. Jameson and colleagues believe there is a limit to how deep a fish can live, and this new record holder is right on the edge of that theoretical limit. Below about 27,000 meters, a fish's body hypothetically cannot produce any more of a substance called an osmolite, which helps their cells withstand the incredible pressure of the deep sea. The deeper you go, the higher the concentration of this substance. This is the thing that's kind of pushing out against all that water pressure. The deeper you go, the higher concentration of these osmolites. When you get to 8,200 meters, there's just no way a theoretical fish can produce more. I'm tempted to say, give them a year. Give them another thing, they'll go down, they'll find one lower. It's kind of dangerous saying God couldn't make one below 26,900 feet. Kind of dangerous. The track record of saying God couldn't isn't very good. If I ever find a follow-up to this and they found one deeper, I'll share it with you. They say, if a fish can go deeper, translate, if God could make one deeper than that, it's different from any other fish on the planet. Probably is. Isaiah chapter 40. We'll wrap it up here. Isaiah chapter 40. It doesn't take you long in studying about valleys before you're brought square up with what a great, powerful creator, a brilliant creator God is. Despite all, in addition to all these other things we've seen about valleys. I want to end with this verse and just have us think about it a bit. This is a very familiar verse to us. In one sense, you say, well, there won't be any more valleys. Isn't that what this says? It's talking about the kingdom of God, the new world. You know, Christ is back and everything's being made different. And there's this very famous verse. Every valley shall be exalted, and every mountain and hill shall be made low. The crooked places shall be made straight, and the rough places smooth. Well, in the first place, yes, God could do something with that 2 miles of water I described. Because if you read that literally, that after Christ comes, everything will be exactly smooth. And he's going to have to do a miracle and get rid of 2 miles of water. Because I already told you, there's enough water on the earth that we'd be 2 miles under. So maybe when we put that consideration again, not that God couldn't, But we also consider what we saw earlier in the sermon, that valleys can be beautiful. God said, it's a good land I give you. It's got valleys and hills in it. And remember also Isaiah 2, the same book. When it's describing the kingdom of God and the capital city of the kingdom of God, how does it describe it? This is Isaiah 2 and verse 2. It shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain, the high place of the Eternal's house, shall be established on the top of a smooth billiard ball. No, it says the other mountains. It shall be established on the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills. That makes it sound like it won't be billiard ball smooth, with 2 miles of water having to be miraculously removed. It sounds like what Isaiah 40 verse 4 is saying. We won't have mountains as tall as Mount Everest. Maybe there'll be moderation. Who can live and grow a garden on the top of Mount Everest? Nobody. Anybody want to buy their plot for the world tomorrow in Death Valley? It'll be a little rough. I think it means it's going to be moderated. The highest of the highs will be brought somewhat low. There'll still be mountains. The lowest of the lows will be brought somewhat up. It won't be Death Valley and Badwater Basin anymore. I think there will still be some hills. Otherwise, how could Jerusalem or the kingdom of God be higher than all the other hills if there are no other hills? If you do that, you're going to open up a lot of arable land on the earth. We're going to have a population explosion. It's going to be 1,000 years of peace. No war, sickness will be dealt with. You're going to need a lot more arable land. And maybe the highest of the high places will be brought low. The lowest of the low places will be brought up some. And we'll have a lot more arable land, and everybody can have their vine and their fig tree and beautiful weather, beautiful soil. So I think when we consider it, we should thank God for the beauty of valleys in the world today. And I think we all look forward to a time when there will be no more negative or troubling dimensions to valleys, but only good, only blessings, and only beauty.